Thank you very much indeed, Jill. And yes, before the White Devil, we're with some musical devils here. Russian stories can be pretty dark, and that's the case with the music inspired by such tales, which begins and ends tonight's All Russian Prom. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where the London Philharmonic, together with its charismatic Russian principal conductor Vladimir Yurovsky, is preparing to do battle with the supernatural. Their programme ends with Prokofiev's supercharged Third Symphony, based on the music he'd composed for his macabre, demon-ridden opera, The Fiery Angel. And set against it is a Scriabin miniature, his dreamy, sensual reverie. Shostakovich wrote his first violin concerto at a time of extreme personal and professional adversity, when Stalin's henchmen were heaping a torrent of abuse on him. And this powerful music was effectively banned from performance until after Stalin's death. Now the concerto is a 20th century classic. It's played tonight by the German virtuoso Julia Fischer. If Shostakovich was being pursued by human demons, then in the first piece on the programme, the imaginary demons are at the centre of things. St. John's Night, which is Midsummer Eve on Bear Mountain, was the original title of Mussorgsky's atmospheric orchestral piece. He actually finished writing it on Midsummer Night itself in many countries, a time when evil spirits are said to appear and enact pagan rites. According to Mussorgsky, the story for the music was of witches gathering on Bear Mountain and gossiping as they wait for their boss, Satan himself. He appears in procession and they sing his praise before their witches' Sabbath begins with a celebration of the Black Mass, and Satan chooses the witches who've caught his fancy. It's the ringing of the bell in the village church which disrupts the orgy and disperses the spirits of darkness. The tone of the work, wrote Mussorgsky, is impassioned and disorderly. After Mussorgsky's death, Rimsky-Korsakov created what almost amounted to his own piece from Mussorgsky's material. Well, the leader of the LPO, Peter Schumann, is already on the Royal Albert Hall platform. He tuned the orchestra. And now here comes the orchestra's principal conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky, to conduct Mussorgsky's Night on the Bear Mountain, arranged by Rimsky-Korsakov. We'll be right back. Mussorgsky's original elemental diabolism remains, but seen through Rimsky-Korsakov's brightly coloured orchestral lens in A Night on the Bare Mountain, performed to open tonight's BBC Prom live on Radio 3 by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Yurovsky. I have to mention those gorgeous solos at the end. Robert Hill, the clarinetist, Jaime Martin, and the flute. And the reason for that quiet, pastoral ending, well, Rimsky claims not to have known Mussorgsky's original orchestrated version and worked on the piano score of a version that Mussorgsky used in his comic opera Sorochinsky Fair, in which the devilry is all in the shepherd's boy's nightmare. He wakes at dawn and plays his pipe to reassure himself. Vladimir Yurovsky back on the platform and bringing Robert Hill and Jaime Martin to their feet before the entire orchestra. So now to Shostakovich and his first violin concerto with Yulia Fischer as soloist. Whatever Mussorgsky thought of life under the Tsars, you suspect he would have found it impossible to comprehend how bad things were for musicians 70 or 80 years later under Stalin's dictatorship. Shostakovich had been living in fear since the mid-30s, but it was in 1948, when he was in the middle of writing the violin concerto, that he and some of his fellow composers began suffering months of terrorizing abuse, which started with them being railed at for their formalist distortions and anti-democratic tendencies. Shostakovich was dismissed from his conservatoire teaching posts, but despite everything, kept on writing the violin concerto, which promptly joined the long list of banned works in the Soviet Union. It was finally performed some 7 years later, when the slow thaw which set in after Stalin's death had reached the point when such complex music was grudgingly allowed. The soloist was David Oistrakh. It was his playing that had originally inspired Shostakovich to write the concerto, and it turned out to be a really symphonic piece on a grand scale. Yulia Fischer rates it very highly indeed.
Shostakovich violin concerto is one of the greatest pieces of the 20th century, and actually one of the greatest violin concertos ever been written. I think that's the greatest thing about Shostakovich, that he was really the composer who wrote in his music what it meant to live in the Soviet Union. And because of his music, we will never forget what it means to live in a totalitarian regime and how important freedom is and how important freedom of speech and freedom of everything is. And that's why it belongs to the greatest pieces ever been written.
David Oistrakh, whose playing really inspired the piece, even he found the concerto exhausting to play, and not least the cadenza before the finale, and and begged Shostakovich to give him a few bars respite at the start of the finale. Does it take a lot out of you too?
Of course, it takes out a lot of any violinist, I believe, and everybody's of course scared of the cadenza, and you are actually never 100% sure if you will make it through the last movement, because you played the cadenza and it may happen that you are really so tired afterwards that you're incapable of playing the last movement, but in the end, you somehow always arrive.
Yulia Fischer. Well, she certainly always arrives. She finds this, I think, a lot easier than most violinists. She's going on tour with this orchestra and Yurovsky later in the year. And she was saying, oh, I could play the Beethoven and the Shostakovich concertos in one evening. And here she comes, followed onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall by Vladimir Yurovsky, joining the LPO to perform Shostakovich's first violin concerto.
Thank you.
Shostakovich ending his first violin concerto with what sounds like a brilliant, high-spirited romp, despite that music being written in the middle of those savage attacks from the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party. Here at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall, we've just heard a performance given by Yulia Fischer with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Yurovsky, who I have to say led the applause for Yulia Fischer's astonishing performance at the end there. Orchestra including two harps, xylophone and celeste, but no trumpets and trombones. And the clarinets were very amused at rehearsal because the tuba was placed by Vladimir Yurovsky between the horns and the clarinets, the interloper. And back comes Yulia Fischer, with all the tails and black dresses. She's in sort of burnished metallic gold, and you can hear what the reception's like. One of the most important works of the 20th century, he says. We'll never forget what a totalitarian regime can do while that music is alive, according to Yulia Fischer. With an advocate like that, you can believe it. She is amazing. I talked about this Beethoven Shostakovich tour. She would be prepared to play both concertos in the same concert. We have to remember this is a girl who at a New Year's Day concert in Frankfurt a couple of years ago played the Saint-Saëns third violin concerto in the first half, and after the interval, the Grieg piano concerto. She was playing the piano in her dressing room earlier, I heard. Back onto the platform with Vladimir Yurovsky. She actually asks to play this concerto, but only with good orchestras and a conductor, she said. You need fantastic wind soloists, the LPO has them, and with Vladimir Yurovsky, it's always a meeting of minds, she says, as they take the applause jauntily. She is going back home to Munich to spend a couple of weeks with family now, but then Beethoven, Izay and Franck with her pianist Milana Chernyavska around Germany, also to Yerevan in Armenia. But first, Izay and Franck here, well, not quite here, but at the Cadogan Hall, a lunchtime prom at 1 tomorrow, and of course live here on Radio 3. Here, once again, comes Julia Fischer, thunderous foot stamping from the Romanadas. I don't think they wanted to go. Uh-huh.
The first movement from the second sonata by Eugène Ysaÿe.
Ysaÿe playing with Bach and the Dies Irae in the first movement of the second sonata for solo violin, played as an encore after her triumphant Shostakovich fiddle concerto by Julia Fischer. I talked to Julia about how concert days are for her. She says she doesn't need much sleep, so she tends to get up early, has a good breakfast, practices, rehearses with the pianist or the orchestra, whatever, has a good lunch, sleep, and then the concert. What a concert. Here she is, back on the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. a slight figure on the platform, but what contrast he gets, what dynamics. Dares to play incredibly quietly and gets great volume when she needs it. Well, as I say, I asked her about her performance day, and I also asked her about post-performance.
After you've played the concert, I mean, say you play at the end of the first half.
Yeah.
Do you then listen to the remainder of it? Do you go out for a drink? Do you put your feet up in the hotel? Any one of the three?
Well, I usually go to the second half and listen. Only if I'm very tired, I don't, or if I don't agree with the interpretation of the second half. But usually I go and listen to the second half. Today I actually also have a rehearsal because I'm playing the recital tomorrow. And Milana Czerniewska, my pianist, was away for 2 weeks, so the only time we can actually rehearse is tonight after the concert. Actually, those are very good times for practicing because the pressure of the concert is off, but you're still very concentrated. Usually people are not very tired after concerts, so it's a good time for practicing. So I hope I will make it to the second half, but then I actually have to rush over to Cadogan Hall and rehearse there.
And you can hear them both playing Franck and Julia Fischer playing the first Isai solo sonata at 1 tomorrow afternoon, live here on Radio 3 from Cadogan Hall. Well, in 20 minutes' time, we'll be back here in the Royal Albert Hall to continue this Russian journey, ending with music by Prokofiev, a composer whose journey in the Stalin era was rather different from Shostakovich's, and whose death went almost completely unnoticed as it fell on the same day as Stalin's own demise. Prokofiev's Third Symphony takes us to a lurid world of spirits and demons in music which began life in his opera The Fiery Angel. And before that, Vladimir Yurovsky and the London Philharmonic take us briefly to the sensuous world of Scriabin. But first, we make the trip down those magnificent steps to the RCM for another visit to the Proms Literary Festival with Susan Hitch.
Hello and welcome to the Royal College of Music and this year's Proms Literary Festival. Tonight's music is Russian. It's a range which takes us from Tsarist Russia to the Soviet Union, from the 19th into the 20th century. And no one shaped Russian thought across this historical period and beyond like the great novelist and thinker Leo Tolstoy. This year is the 100th anniversary of his death. Nowadays, he's best known for his novels, War and Peace and Anna Karenina, but in his long life, Tolstoy became Russia's great thinker, a philosopher of the simple and self-denying life. And as a spiritual teacher, he influenced Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. When he died at 82, hordes of reporters were dispatched to his deathbed, logging the great man's last hours in intimate detail. But he'd rejected not only his louche and rakish youth, but his novels and their abundant life. He said they weren't real enough. So this severe ascetic, deeply disgusted at his own sensuality, was he in fact driven by an overwhelming misanthropy and pessimism? I'm joined by two guests who'll help us to answer this question. Anthony Briggs, who's Tolstoy's biographer and translator, and the writer and former Moscow correspondent James Meek, whose novel The People's Act of Love is set in Siberia during the Russian Revolution. And we'll also be hearing some extracts from Tolstoy's work read for us by John Rowe. Please welcome them now. James, I'm fascinated by the accounts of Tolstoy's deathbed, all those people. There's reporters and crowds. It's very modern. How did they even know it was happening?
Well, they took advantage of the two great inventions of the age, the railway and the telegraph. And these two networks, the telegraph has been described as the Victorian internet. These two networks sort of overlapped. And so not only was it possible to find out very quickly that, rather conveniently, Tolstoy had fallen ill in such a way that he was there at a railway station. Not only was it possible to quickly find out through the telegraph that this had happened, but of course it was possible to get there very quickly as well through the railways. So within a very short space of time, this huge crowd had gathered. There were, of course, bystanders. There were spies from the Tsarist secret police who considered him to be very much their enemy at this time. And of course, there was this vast crowd of reporters who, by the medium of the telegraph, which was right there, were able to file these. I mean, you said blogging, and people probably think this is just a joke, but I mean, really, the way that they kept updating their reports was almost like the internet now. I mean, they would say, correction, he didn't have two eggs, he just had some tea. And they would keep sending out these reports, and sometimes the newspapers the next day, when they were published, they would publish these sequential, minute-by-minute accounts of every sip and gulp and whisper of Tolstoy.
And Tony, why was he so famous?
Tolstoy at that time was possibly the most famous man in the whole world. But I think we ought to realise that when we think about his death and his funeral, we're actually burying a different person from the one that we now know and revere, because he was widely known by anyone who had any kind of left-wing or anti-government sentiment at all over the world, because he was anti-authoritarian, he was anti-government, he was against military service and corporal punishment and everything you could possibly think of. And it was for those reasons that he was really a very, very famous man. Now it's all shaken down 100 years later, and we still know him now for the great wisdom that he communicates to us, but it's not essentially the same wisdom that pure Tolstoyism wanted to impart to us. This is the wisdom of Pierre Bezukhov and the characters who go through such travail in War and Peace. There is real wisdom there.
Tolstoy wasn't born a Tolstoyan, was he? Where did this come from? He's 82 when he dies. It's a very long life.
In my little new biography of Tolstoy, I've taken rather a new line on him. And I was suddenly shocked with one piece of awareness. Tolstoy finished War and Peace in 1869, and having done that, he did what any of us would do. He went off to learn Greek, and it took him 3 months, and he went all the way through Greek in 3 months. And he also read widely, and catastrophically, he read the worst man in the whole of philosophy, Arthur Schopenhauer, the German pessimist. And Tolstoy devoured him in that year. There were two other occasions, critical moments in his life. First of all, when he encountered Rousseau, when he was in his teens. And what happened here was that Tolstoy had been brought up by a fairly strict Orthodox family with, I would have thought, rather high morality, and he was disgusted with himself. And when he read Rousseau, he suddenly realized that he wasn't the only person who couldn't control his animal urges, that men are vile creatures. This is what Rousseau had taught him and confirmed in him. And he hated himself, and through that he came to hate humanity. And the third person in this little triumvirate is a man you'll have heard of and seen him if you've been looking at the Helen Mirren film, The Last Station. This ghastly man, Vladimir Chertkov, who came in at the end of his life, who is himself an arrogant, obsessive, Calvinist, pure Tolstoyan, which Tolstoy himself was not. This is the real Tolstoy. It's not the Tolstoy you get in War and Peace. The War and Peace was written the only time of Tolstoy's life when he really was a happy man, newly married, all the sex he wanted with an eight. And by the way, I'm not dragging this in. This is a major preoccupation of Tolstoy's, with a beautiful young 18-year-old girl, and the birth of three children while War and Peace was being written. For a few months, he was a happy man. Otherwise, throughout the whole of his life, from beginning to end, he was very, very unhappy, and he found confirmation of his nasty view of humanity and of life itself in Rousseau and Schopenhauer and Chertkov.
I think we'll come back to that. But I think first we'll go to Tolstoy, the happy man, and our first reading from War and Peace, which was written, as you say, when Tolstoy was in his 30s and a happy family man. Here we have Prince Andrei Bolkonski, who is himself damaged and disillusioned by death and war. And he's driving through the forest, and he's looking for a gnarled old oak tree, which he last saw in winter when it was nearly dead. John.
It was early June when, on his return journey, he drove once again into the birch wood, where the gnarled oak tree had made such a strangely indelible impression on him. That oak tree, it was somewhere near here in the forest. There was such an affinity between us, he thought, but where was it? As he wondered, he glanced across left and, unconsciously, without recognizing it, began to admire the very tree that he was looking for. The old oak was completely transformed, now spreading out a canopy of lush dark foliage and stirring gently as it wallowed in the evening sunshine. No trace now of the gnarled fingers, the scars, the old sadness and misgivings. Succulent young leaves with no twigs had burst straight through the hard bark of 100 years. It was almost incredible that this old fellow should have grown them. Oh, yes, that's the one, thought the prince, spontaneously overwhelmed by one of those surges of delight and renewal that belong to springtime. All the best times of his life came together sharply in his memory. The lofty sky at Austerlitz, the look of reproach on his dead wife's face, Pierre on the ferry, and that young girl who had been so enthralled by the night's beauty, the night itself and the moon. Suddenly he remembered it all. No, life isn't over at 31, was his instant, final, and irrevocable conclusion.
I'm very glad life isn't over at 31. Tony, you chose this piece for us. Why?
Well, because it's got the essence of Tolstoy in it, actually. And this is the good side and the very wise side. Tolstoy is famous for having probably the most comprehensive vision of humanity and human life in his works than any other writer, Shakespeare aside. War and Peace has been described as the intimate epic, which is marvellous because it shows that when he's dealing with Natasha and with the ordinary everyday characters, and there are more than 500 of them in War and Peace, he does it with an intimacy and a detail which is totally persuasive. But he also deals with great philosophical visions as well. And one of the points that he makes, which is very useful for all of us, is this. When you are down, don't get too depressed, because there's a good chance that the wheel of fortune will turn and you will come back up again. Conversely, when you're at the top and things are going well, don't ever get too complacent and cocky, because the wheel's going to take you down again. Now, this cyclic movement in human affairs, he saw this also in nature and in society generally and in the processes of warfare and all that sort of thing. And it's essentially a very positive message. By the way, that's the message you get from War and Peace, that the characters there, who all of them, by the way, begin with immense privileges. They've got enough money and lifestyle like the Beckhams today, infinitely rich, beautiful women at their beck and call, and all of them make a complete hash of it, show how difficult it is. The Russians have a simple proverb, you know, «Жизнь прожить, не поле перейти». Living a life is not like just walking across a field. And that's what War and Peace tells us. But the residue from War and Peace is wholly optimistic. It's worth it. It's Anna Karenina, which began punitively before it even started. He knew that the epigraph is, vengeance is mine. And he began with the determination to destroy Anna. That's because he'd read Schopenhauer in between and it changed his attitude from one to the other. But you look at the two novels and see whether
I
you agree.
Drag the conversation away from Schopenhauer just for a moment. I wanted to stay with War and Peace for a moment and ask James, I mean, it is this huge novel, as Tony's just pointed out, and it's full of people and births and marriages and deaths. It's hatch, match and dispatch again and again and again. It's full of philosophy and history. I mean, some readers have had a problem with whether it all hangs together.
Yes, myself included, I must say. I mean, I certainly came here to praise Tolstoy extravagantly. I think he's a genius, an artistic genius. I'm fascinated by his life and his pronouncements on how we should live it, but I'm not too much worried by the contradictions between that, what he said and what he did. I'm more interested in him as an artist.
And do you think that it's important that we already have a kind of darker Tolstoy there?
Very, very early on, his character appears. I mean, we've already talked about what a long life he lived, but I just want to stress again what a long writing life he lived. I mean, he appeared in the public consciousness with this first short novel, Childhood, which is a fictionalized memoir. He was only 24 when that came out. He was a young aristocrat. He was nobody really. But in that first those first few pages of this very first book of this huge long writing life, where this child is already making rules for himself and breaking those rules, when he's angry with his tutor, and then he immediately is angry with himself for being angry with this wonderful man. You're right there. at the age of 24, and within the age of 24, sort of nested like a Russian doll, the 10-year-old Tolstoy. It's already there, that contradiction. I feel this passion. No, it's wrong. I hate it. I don't want to do that. And that, so you can talk about Schopenhauer, and I recognize the Tolstoy that Tony describes, but my question would be, well, why was he so ready for Schopenhauer when he found him? Why was he so ready for Rousseau? I think the character of Tolstoy was already formed. And in that, in the first pages of that first book, there's something else as well which Tony touched on, which I think sort of guided his entire life. It starts with him and his tutor. He then goes on to this other range of domestic servants, the butler, the people in the kitchen. He then goes out, the family goes out hunting, and you have this whole army of huntsmen and grooms attending to them. And so you have these concentric rings of servants, and outside this ring, you then have this vast army of peasants toiling in the fields, all belonging to the Tolstoy family. This was the very, very high material point that he started from. From that moment, his whole life was a history of attempted renunciation, whether it was his passions or whether it was his material property that he was landed with. He just spent his whole life trying and not always succeeding to give things up, including some of the great masterpieces that he produced.
This seems a good moment for the second reading, which is from Tolstoy's second great novel, Big Ones, written a decade after War and Peace, Anna Karenina. Here is Levin, the young landowner, with his friends, John.
Waking up in the first light of dawn, Levin tried to rouse his companions. Vasenka, lying on his stomach with one stocking leg thrust out, was sleeping so soundly that he could get no response from him. Oblonsky refused sleepily to get up so early. Even Laska, who was asleep, curled in a ring on the edge of the hay, got up reluctantly, lazily stretching out and straightening her hind legs, one after the other. Having put on his boots, picked up his gun, and carefully opened the creaking door of the barn, Levin went outside. The coachmen were sleeping in the carriages, the horses were dozing. Only one was lazily eating oats, dipping her snout into the trough. The outside world was still grey.
Tolstoy, I think, does the best descriptions of just hanging out that I know, and it's in the middle of your concentric circle, isn't it? It's the aristocratic ease.
But he's not hanging out. That's why I chose that passage. I wanted, first of all, just to show what a deceptively simple writer he is. If you compare it to what is considered to be the sort of the perfect example of the modern novel, there are no grand metaphors. These sentences are not rich and cluttered with imagery. That's the first thing. The other thing is that the description is all in terms of movement. Levin wants something. He is going somewhere. He's going out to hunt. He's not standing looking through a window at the world. He's not putting his hands in his pockets and reflecting on life. He's going somewhere. As he describes these people asleep, he's actually making a journey to a particular point. And there's a wider context to this as well, the hunt. What's happened prior to this scene is that Levin has been hunting with his two friends, and he's failed completely to shoot anything. His friends have had a great hunt. They've killed lots of birds, and Levin is just completely screwed up. But here, his friends are sleeping. They're exhausted. Levin goes out by himself. He's playing the long game. He's going to go out while they're still asleep, and he is going to kill this huge number of birds. And in a way, you've got this reflection of Levin, that the Tolstoy character in Anna Karenina, who is playing that long game. Yes, other people may have their glories in the world, but he just goes on doggedly, reading his books, thinking his thoughts. He is ready for the longer, the bigger prey.
Tony, how much of Tolstoy is there in this character, Levin?
Well, there's an absolutely huge amount. I was just reflecting on that, and if you hadn't invited me, and I was going to invite James to recall a scene in towards the end of Anna Karenina, when Levin's baby is born. Now, I've had this experience as a father, watching my two daughters come into the world and holding them for that first magic moment. And I felt what I think every father would feel. My thoughts were very simply, how wonderful. I will make sure. I will protect you. I will help you. You're in for the most gorgeous life, and I'm going to see that it happens to you. What does Levin say? He looks at his new baby, holds the baby, and he said, my God, how vulnerable. All that suffering ahead of you. That is pure Schopenhauer, who believes that our earthly life is totally made up of suffering. And if you ever get beyond that, it becomes boredom. And so, and by the way, there is one other point about this. I'm not doing this because it's a hobby or I've suddenly gone off at a weird tangent. There is a real reason that I've brought all this forward. Tolstoy in his own personal life was an absolute swine. He was a very, very nasty man all the way through his life, from his childhood through his teens as a junior officer. Turgenev called him a troglodyte in society. The officers couldn't get on with him. They found him arrogant. He had a piercing, beetling look that drilled through everyone. And he was so arrogant, so self-centered throughout the whole of his life that he's a very nasty man. Now, does it matter? You may say Verlaine was like that, or I don't know, Picasso led a bad life, but we forget about their sins because of the great works that they've bequeathed to us. Well, I put it to you that in the case of Tolstoy, you can't forget it, because Tolstoy tells us from the beginning of his life to the end of it that the only thing that matters in human affairs is love. And there has never been a great writer less capable of offering love and charity to those nearest and dearest to him. And that's why I take this rather negative view, that this horrible man deserves to be castigated in those terms. And that doesn't
James.
Mean I don't like his work, which I do.
James, do you share this view, and does it matter?
No, I don't share this view. I think Tony is harsh. He was greatly loved, even his wife, even though he did, as Tony rightly says, treat her appallingly, really badly. She still loved him before and after he died.
And I'm afraid that's where we have to leave it. Thank you very much indeed to my guests, James Meek and Tony Briggs, to our reader, John Rowe, and to all of you in our audience here at the Royal College of Music, and of course to our listeners on Radio 3.
Susan Hitch was talking to the novelist James Meek and translator Anthony Briggs. The reader was John Rowe. The programme was produced by Natalie Steed, and that event in the Proms Literary Festival took place just a couple of hours ago. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Hadley, to the second part of tonight's BBC Prom live here on Radio 3. In a few minutes' time, the London Philharmonic's principal conductor, Vladimir Lorovsky, with his orchestra, will perform the symphony which Prokofiev regarded as one of his best works, his third, whose genesis and content stem from his opera The Fiery Angel, a study of psychological tension. Well, the young Prokofiev was a fan of the music of Alexander Scriabin, and by way of a tribute, he dedicated his symphonic picture Night Dreams to him, Scriabin having begun his career as a composer of orchestral music with Daydreams, or Reverie, which the LPO play next. Scriabin was born some 20 years before Prokofiev and belonged to the same generation as his friend Rachmaninoff. Like both of the other men, Scriabin was a renowned concert pianist. He taught piano for several years around 1900 at the Moscow Conservatoire. He composed all his earlier music for piano, but perhaps because he heard other instruments around him every day at the conservatory, he turned increasingly to composing for orchestra, beginning with a piano concerto. That work was written as a result of some serious pleading from Scriabin's patron, the timber merchant turned music publisher Mitrofan Belayev. Scriabin was always in need of money, and Belayev treated him like a profligate son, demanding detailed accounts of what he'd done and spent, telling him what to do, bullying him to write music. Scriabin fended him off with evasiveness and downright lies. He didn't mention the Reverie to Belayev until he rolled into St. Petersburg with it under his arm, but Belayev was delighted by the little piece. In fact, he gave what Scriabin had originally called simply Prelude its name. Reverie has the same shape as many of the 100 or so piano pieces Scriabin had written by this time, in which he builds an idea to a big climax before letting it fade away again, and all lasting just a few minutes. Reverie may be unambitious, but its sensual mood and its colours could have been created by no one else. So now, here is Vladimir Lyovsky returning to the Royal Albert Hall platform to conduct the LPO in Scriabin's Reverie. Scriabin's Daydream Fades, his Reverie, performed by the London Philharmonic, conducted by Vladimir Yurovsky, to open the second part of this BBC Prom live here on Radio 3. And after that piece, Scriabin became a symphonist. You can hear the first symphony tomorrow at the BBC Proms, the LSO and Gergiev. And finally this evening to the Third Symphony by the man who was a young composer, greatly admired that music, Sergei Prokofiev. In the mid-20s, he was living in Paris, intending to become a French citizen, enjoying the cultural whirl of the Roaring Twenties. He spent much of the decade writing and then trying to get a production for his opera, The Fiery Angel. He hoped it would establish him at the forefront of the operatic world, a study in psychological tension with a macabre plot from a symbolist novel set in the Middle Ages in which the deluded heroine is caught in the grip of sorcery and satanic forces. Prokofiev was never one to waste the material from his stage works if they were slow in being presented on stage. He usually produced an orchestral suite from the best bits, but in this case he did much more, reworking chunks of music into a major new work. And here, once again, comes Vladimir Yurovsky to conduct the London Philharmonic in Prokofiev's Third Symphony. Thank you. music of sorcery and the black arts. When the pianist Svetislav Richter first heard that piece, he was bowled over, saying the impression it made was staggering. It was like the end of the world. Prokofiev's Third Symphony has just been performed here in Royal Albert Hall to end this BBC Prom by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Peter Schumann, with its principal conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky. First performed in Paris in 1929, conducted by Pierre Monteux. Prokofiev himself conducted the UK premiere at the BBC Contemporary Music Invitation Concert some 5 years later. It even had a performance in Stalin's Russia before Prokofiev had decided to go back. Music exploring that sacred edge which divides our world from the dark sphere in which float spirits and demons, according to Valery Bryusov, who wrote the Symbolist novel. Vladimir Yurovsky back on platform with his orchestra, the LPO, on its feet. They're working hard, of course, as usual in the summer at Kleinborn. Tomorrow, they're back down there with the devil, indeed. The Rake's Progress with Yurovsky conducting. Yesterday, it was Hansel and Gretel with Robin Ticciardi, and you can hear that production on the 31st of August at the BBC Proms. Lydia Teuscher and Alice Coote as the children. It's all go for the LPO as Vladimir Yurovsky comes back on the platform. Tomorrow at BBC Proms, lunchtime, as I was saying earlier, the Proms chamber music recital given by tonight's soloist Julia Fischer and Milana Chernyavska. And we're back here at the Royal Albert Hall, musically back in Russia indeed, 7:30 tomorrow with the LSO, the LS Chorus, and Valery Gergiev for a rather larger dose of Scriabin in his colossal first symphony in six movements, including a choral finale in praise of art. Now, where have we heard that before? Vladimir Yurovsky bringing the brass to their feet. Now it's the percussion, and I think this is the horn section. And the wind principle's been brought to their feet. Well, tomorrow evening, as I say, we've got Scriabin's first symphony, followed by a centenary performance, if you like, of the brilliant complete score for Stravinsky's first ballet, The Firebird. That's all, of course, live here on Radio 3. But for now, with a vibrant Royal Albert Hall, I'd say, time for me to hand you on to Jill Anderson in Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Thank you very much, Martin. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom again on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. And if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, then visit the bbc.co.uk/proms and click on Share. Well, coming up in 6 minutes or so, our drama on three, a play called The White Devil by John Webster. Then at 11:15, Words and Music. Jonathan Firth and Hayden Gwynn read poetry and prose about the provincial France. And at 12:45, jazz lineup, highlights of a set by the Swedish trombonist Nils Landgren and the NDR Big Band, featuring original material alongside repertoire by Herbie Hancock. So that's the rest of the evening here on BBC Radio 3. So before our play, The White Devil, I thought we'd hear some more music by Scriabin. This is Vers la Flamme, played by Nikolai Demidenko. Thank you. Nikolai Demidenko playing music by Scriabin, Vers la Flamme, Opus 72. And just a reminder that you can hear Scriabin's first symphony tomorrow evening at the Prom, which begins at 7:30, and you can hear that live here on BBC Radio 3. Well, the time now is 9:15, time for Drama on 3. John Webster's classic play, The White Devil, which was first performed in London in 1612. Our new production sets this dark story of murder and revenge in a 1950s underworld, a world of mutable morality, shifting alliances and sudden violence. Patrick Kennedy, Anna Maxwell-Martin and Francis de la Tour star in The White Devil by John Webster.
To hear the sentence. Fortune's a right whore. If she give all, she deals it in small parcels that she may take away all at one swoop. This 'tis to have great enemies. God quiet them.
Come, Ludovico. You're justly doomed. Look but a little back into your former life. You have in 3 years ruined the finest business.
Those fellows which were invited to your prodigal feast laugh at your misery. As for deeming you an idle meteor which drawn forth the earth would soon be lost to the air.
Jest upon you, and say you were begotten in an earthquake. You have ruined such fair concerns.
Worse than these, you have acted certain murders here in Rome, bloody and full of horror.
Alas, they were flea-bitings. Why took they not my head then?
The law doth sometimes mediate. Thinks it good not ever to steep violent sins in blood. This gentle penance may both end your crimes and in the example better these bad times.
So, but I wonder then some great men scape this banishment. There's Bracciano, now lives in Rome, and by close panderism seeks to prostitute the honour of Vittoria Corombona. Vittoria, she that might have got my pardon for one kiss to Francisco.
I have a full man within you.
Leave your painted comforts. I'll make Italian cutworks in their guts if ever I return.
Lodovico.
I am patient. I've seen some ready to be executed give pleasant looks and money and grown familiar with the knave hangman. So do I. I thank them and would account them nobly merciful would they dispatch me quickly.
Well, fare you well. We shall find time, I doubt not, to repeal your banishment.
I'm ever bound to you. This is the world's arms. Pray make use of it. Great men sell sheep, thus to be cut in pieces, when first they have shorn them bare and sold their fleeces.
Oh, one, two, three, four!
Flamineo.
Sir.
Oh, I lost. Flamineo.
Pursue your noble wishes. I am prompt as lightning to your service. The fair Vittoria, my happy sister, shall give you present audience.
Are we so happy?
Can it be otherwise? Observed you not tonight, which way soe'er you went, she threw her eyes. I have dealt already with her maid, Zanki, and she is wondrous proud to be the agent for so high a spirit.
We are happy above thought, because above merit...
Above merit? We may now talk freely above merit. What is't you doubt? her coyness. That's but the superficies of lust most women have. Yet why should ladies blush to hear that named which they do not fear to handle? Oh, they are politic. They know our desire is increased by the difficulty of enjoying, whereas satiety is a blunt, weary, and drowsy passion. If the buttery hatch stood continually open, there'd be nothing so passionate crowding, nor hot suit after the beverage.
Oh, but a jealous husband.
Hang him, a gilder that hath his brains perished with quicksilver is not more cold in the liver. So unable to please a woman that all his back is shrunk into his breeches. Shroud you within. Some trick now must be thought on to divide my brother-in-law from his fair bedfellow. Oh,
should she fail to come?
I must not have your lordship thus unwisely amorous. I myself have loved a lady and pursued her with a great deal of underage protestation, whom some 3 or 4 gallants that have enjoyed with all their hearts have been glad to have been rid of. It is just like a summer birdcage in a garden. The birds that are without despair to get in, and the birds that are within despair and are in a consumption for fear they shall never get out. See, here he comes. Away, away, sir. This man, Camillo, by his apparel, some men would judge a politician. But call his wit in question, you shall find it merely an ass in his footcloth. How now, brother? What, travelling to bed with your kind wife?
I assure you, brother, no. My voyage lies more northerly, in a far colder clime. I do not well remember, I protest, when I last lay with her.
Strange you should lose your count.
We never lay together, but ere morning there grew a flaw between us.
It had been your part to have made up that flaw.
True, but she loathes I should be seen in.
Why, sir, what's the matter?
Your master, Bracciano, visits me, I thank him. And I perceive how, like an earnest bowler, he very passionately leans that way he should have his bowl run.
I hope you do not think...
That nobleman bowl booty... Faith, his cheek hath a most excellent bias. It would fain jump with my mistress.
God be with you. I do commit you to your pitiful pillow stuffed with horn shavings.
Brother.
Might I advise you now, your only course were to lock up your wife.
To a very good.
Bar her the sight of revels.
Excellent.
Let her not go to church, but like a hound in leash at your heels.
Twere for her honour.
And so you should be certain in 1 fortnight, despite her chastity or innocence, to be cuckolded. Which yet is in suspense. This is my counsel, and I ask no fee for it.
This doth not physic me.
It seems you are jealous. I'll show you the error of it by a familiar example. I've seen a pair of spectacles, fashioned with such perspective art, that lay down but 1 12-pence of the board. 'Twill appear as if there were 20. Oh. Now, should you wear a pair of these spectacles, and see your wife... tying her shoe, you would imagine 20 hands were taking up of your wife's clothes, and this would put you into a horrible, causeless fury.
The fault there, sir, is not in the eyesight.
True, but they that have the yellow jaundice think all objects they look on to be yellow. See, she comes. What reason have you to be jealous of this creature? What an ignorant ass or flattering knave might be counted that should write sonnets to her eyes, or call her brow the snow of Ida or ivory of Corinth, or compare her hair to the blackbird's bill when 'tis liker the blackbird's feather. This is all. Be wise. Bar your wife of her entertainment. Women are more willingly and more gloriously chaste when they are least restrained of their liberty. I will make you friends, and you shall go to bed together. Marry. Look you, it shall not be your seeking. Do you stand upon that by any means? Walk you aloof. I would not have you seen in it. Sister, Bracciano attends you within. Your husband is wondrous discontented.
I did nothing to displease him. I carved him at supper time.
You need not have carved him, in faith. They say he's a capon already. I must now seemingly fall out with you. Shall a gentleman so well descended as Camillo, a lousy slave that within this 20 years rode with the blackguard monk spits and dripping pads...
Now he begins to tickle her.
An excellent scholar, one that hath a head filled with calf's brains without any sage in them, come crouching in the hams to you for a night's lodging? Is he not a courtly gentleman? When he wears white satin, one would take him by his black muzzle to be no other creature than a maggot.
He will make her know what is in me.
Come, Bracciano attends you. Thou shalt go to bed to my master. I am opening your case hard, Camilla.
Now he comes to it. A virtuous brother, on my credit.
Thou shalt lie in a bed stuffed with turtle's feathers, swoon in perfumed linen like the fellow was smothered in roses. Oh. So perfect shall be thy happiness that as men at sea think land and trees and ships go that way they go, so both heaven and earth shall seem to go your voyage. Mm. Shalt meet him, 'tis fixed with nails of diamonds to inevitable necessity.
Thou shalt rid him hence.
Ah, but flies in his tail set him gadding presently. I have almost wrought her to it. I find her coming. But might I advise you now, for this night I would not lie with her. I would cross her humour to make her more humble.
Shall I? Shall I?
It will show in you a supremacy of judgment.
True.
Right. You are the adamant shall draw her to you, though you keep your distance off.
A philosophical reason.
Vittoria?
Oh!
Brother. I cannot be induced... Or as a man would say, incited.
To do what, sir?
To lie with you tonight.
Oh.
Your silkworm used to fast every third day, and the next following spins the better. Huh. Tomorrow at night, I am for you.
You'll spin a fair thread, trust to it.
Tell me tomorrow how scurvily she takes my unkind parting.
I will.
Didst thou not mark the chest of the silkworm? Good night, i'faith. I will use this trick often.
Do. Do, do. So now you are safe. Thou entanglest thyself in thine own work like a silkworm. Sir, the way is clear. Come, sister. Darkness hides your blush. Women are like cursed dogs. Civility keeps them tied all daytime, but they are let loose at midnight. Then they do most good or most mischief.
Give credit. I could wish time would stand still and never end this interview, this hour. But all delight doth itself soonest devour. Let me into your bosom, happy lady, and pour out, instead of eloquence, my vows. Loose me not, madam, for if you forego me, I am lost eternally.
Sir, in the way of pity, I wish you heart whole.
You are a sweet physician.
Sure, sir, I loathed cruelty in ladies is as to doctors' many funerals. It takes away their credit.
Excellent creature. We call the cruel fair. What name for you that are so merciful?
See, now they close. Most happy union.
What value is this jewel?
'Tis the ornament of a weak fortune.
In sooth, I'll have him. Nay, I will but change my jewel for your jewel.
Excellent. His jewel for her jewel.
Nay, let me see you wear it.
Here, sir.
Nay, lower. You shall wear my jewel lower.
To pass away the time, I'll tell your grace a dream I had last night.
Most wishedly.
A foolish, idle dream. Methought I walked about the mid of night into a churchyard, where a goodly yew tree spread her large root in ground. Under that yew, as I sat sadly leaning on a grave, checkered with cross sticks, there came stealing in your wife, Isabella, and my husband. One of them a pickaxe bore, the other a rusty spade, and in rough terms they began to challenge me about this yew.
That tree?
This harmless yew. They told me my intent was to root up that well-grown yew and plant in the stead of it a withered blackthorn. And for that they vowed to bury me alive. My husband straight with pickaxe gan to dig, and your fell Isabella with shovel like a fury voided out the earth and scattered bones. Lord, how methought I trembled. And yet for all this terror I could not pray.
No, the devil was in your dream.
When, to my rescue, there arose... Methought a whirlwind, which let fall a massy arm from that strong plant, and both were struck dead by that sacred yew, in that base, shallow grave that was their due.
Excellent devil. She hath taught him in a dream to make away his wife and her husband.
Sweetly shall I interpret this your dream. You are lodged... within his arms who shall protect you from all the fevers of a jealous husband, from the poor envy of phlegmatic Isabella. I'll seat you above law and above scandal,
Give to your thoughts the invention of delight and the fruition. Nor shall government divide me from you longer than a care to keep you great. You shall to me at once be health, wife, children, friends, and all.
Mother.
My fears have fallen upon me. Oh, my heart. My son, the panda. Now I find our house sinking to ruin. Earthquakes leave behind where they have tyrannized iron or lead or stone, but woe to ruin. Violent lust leaves none.
What fury raised thee up? Away, away.
What make you here, sir, this dead of night? Never dropped mildew on a flower here till now.
I pray, will you go to bed then, lest you be blasted?
Oh, that this fair garden had first been made a nursery for witchcraft, rather than a burial plot for both your honours.
Dearest mother, hear me.
Oh, that has made my brow bend to the earth sooner than nature. See the curse of children. In life they keep us frequently in tears, and in the cold grave leave us in pale fears.
Come, come, I will not hear you.
Brachiano.
Where is thy wife now, adulterous man? Thou little dreamt'st this night she's come to Rome.
How? Come to Rome?
Isabella?
She had been better to...
The lives of great men should like dials move, whose regular example is so strong they make the times by them go right or wrong.
So have you done.
Unfortunate Camillo.
I do protest. If any chaste denial, if anything but blood could have allayed his long suit to me,
I will join with thee to the most woeful end ere mother kneeled. If thou dishonour thus thy husband's bed, be thy life short, as are the funeral tears in great men.
Fie, fie, the woman's mad.
Be thy act Judas-like, betray in kissing. Mayst thou be envied during his short breath, and pitied like a wretch after his death.
Oh, me accursed.
Are you out of your wits? Sir, I'll fetch her back again.
No, I'll to bed. Send Dr. Giulio to me presently. Uncharitable woman, thy rash tongue hath raised a fearful and prodigious storm. Be thou the cause of all ensuing harm.
Now, you that stand so much upon your honour, is this a fitting time of night, think you, to send him home without e'er a man? I would fain know where lies the mass of wealth which you have hoarded for my maintenance, that I may bear my beard out of the level of my lord's stirrup.
What? Because we are poor, shall we be vicious?
Pray, what means have you to keep me from the galleys? Or the gallows? My father proved himself a gentleman, sold all his land, and like a fortunate fellow, died ere the money was spent. You brought me up at Padua, I confess, where I protest for want of means, the university judge me, I have been fain to heal my tutor's stockings at least 7 years. Conspiring with a beard made me a graduate. Then to this man's service I visited the court, whence I returned more courteous, more lecherous by far, but not a suit the richer. And shall I, having a path so open and so free to my preferment, still retain your milk in my pale forehead? No, this face of mine I'll arm and fortify with lusty wine against shame and blushing.
Oh, that I ne'er had borne thee.
So would I. I would the commonest courtesan in Rome had been my mother rather than thyself.
Oh!
Nature is very pitiful to whores, to give them but few children, yet those children, plurality of fathers, they are sure they shall not want.
Misery of miseries.
Go. Go. Complain unto Monte Celso. It may be my Lord Cardinal will justify the act. So, Isabella come to Rome. I like not that. We are engaged to mischief and must on. As rivers to find out the ocean flow with crook bendings beneath forced banks, or as we see to aspire some mountain's top, the way ascends not straight, but imitates the subtle foldings of a winter's snake. So, who knows policy and her true aspect, she'll find her ways winding and indirect.
Have you not seen your husband since you arrived?
Not yet.
Surely he is wondrous kind. If I had such a dove house as Camillo's, I would set fire and at work but to destroy the polecats that haunt to it.
Sir, Bracciano is here.
Sister, away. You must not yet be seen.
I do beseech you, entreat him mildly. Let not your rough tongue set us at louder variance. All his wrongs are freely pardoned. And I do not doubt these arms shall charm his poison, force it to obeying, and keep him chaste from an infected strain.
I wish it may. Begone. You are welcome. Will you sit? Monticelso, be you my orator. My heart's too full. I'll second you anon.
Ere I begin, let me entreat you, sir, forgo all passion which may be raised by my free discourse.
As silent as either church. You may proceed.
It is a wonder to your noble friends that you, having as twere entered the world with a free scepter in your able hand, and having to the use of nature well applied high gifts of learning, should, in your prime age, neglect your awful throne for the soft down of an insatiate bed? Oh, my friend, the drunkard after all his lavish cups is dry, and then is sober. So at length, when you awake from this lascivious dream, repentance then will follow like the sting placed in the adder's tail. When they to willful shipwreck lose good fame, all princely titles perish with their name.
You have said, Father.
Enough to give you taste how far I am from flattering your greatness.
Now you that are his second, what say you? Do not like young hawks fetch a course about? Your game flies fair. And for you.
But do not fear it. I'll answer you in your own hawking phrase. Some eagles that should gaze upon the sun seldom soar high, but take their lustful ease, since they from dunghill birds their prey can seize. You know Vittoria?
Yes.
You shift your shirt there when you retire from tennis?
Happily.
Her husband is man of a poor fortune, yet she wears cloth of tissue.
What of this?
She is your strumpet.
Uncivil, sir. This hemlock in thy breath, and that black slander. Were she a whore of mine, all thy loud cannons, nor thy sworn confederates, durst not supplant
Let's her. Let's not talk on thunder. Thou hast a wife, our sister. Would I had given both her white hands to death, bound and locked fast in her last winding sheet, when I gave thee but one.
Spit thy poison.
I shall not need. Lust carries her sharp whip at her own girdle. Look to it, for our anger is making thunderbolts.
Thunder, in faith, they are but crackers.
We'll end this with the cannon.
Thou'll get naught by it, but iron in thy wounds and gunpowder in thy nostrils.
Gentlemen, you shall not word it any further without a milder limit.
You proclaimed a triumph, that you bait a lion thus.
Bracciano.
I am tame, sir.
The commission is prepared, sir.
Anon. Come, Bracciano. You and I are friends.
Most wishedly. Like bones which, broken sunder and well set, knit them more strongly.
You have received the rumour how Lodovico is turned pirate?
Yes.
We are now preparing to fetch him in. Behold, my sister. We now will leave you and expect from you nothing but kind entreaty.
You have charmed me. You are in health, we see.
And above health, to see you well.
So. I wonder much what amorous whirlwind hurried you to Rome.
Devotion, my love.
Devotion? Is your soul charged with any grievous sin?
'Tis burdened with too many. And I think the oftener that we cast our reckonings up, our sleep will be the sounder.
Take your chamber.
Nay, I will not have you angry. Doth not my absence from you now 2 months merit one kiss?
I do not use to kiss. If that will dispossess your jealousy, I'll swear it to you.
Oh, my love, I do not come to chide my jealousy. I am to learn what that Italian means. You are as welcome to these longing arms as I to you, a virgin.
Oh, your breath! Out upon sweetmeats and continued physic! The plague is in them!
You have oft for these two lips neglected cassia, or the natural sweets of the spring violet. They are not yet much withered. I should be merry. These your frowns show in a helmet lovely, but on me, in such a peaceful interview, methinks they are too roughly knit.
Oh, dissemblance! Do you bandy factions against me? Have you learned the trick of impudent baseness to complain unto your kindred?
Never!
Must I be hunted out? Or was your trick to meet some amorous gallant here in Rome and must supply a discontinuance?
Pray, sir, burst my heart, and in my death turn to your ancient pity, though not
because
love.
Because your brother is the corpulent duke, that is, the great duke. Death, I shall not shortly racket away 500 crowns at tennis, but it shall rest upon record. I scorn him. All his reverend wit lies in his wardrobe. Your brother, the great duke, because he has power and now and then ransacks the Turk. Now all the hellish furies take his soul, first made this match. Accursed be the priest that sang the wedding mass and even my issue.
Oh, too far have you cursed.
Your hand I'll kiss. This is the latest ceremony of my love. Henceforth, I'll never lie with thee. By this wedding ring, I'll ne'er more lie with thee. And this divorce shall be as truly kept as if the judge had doomed it. Fare you well. Our sleeps are severed.
Forbid it. The sweet union of all things blessed, why the saints in heaven will knit their brows at that.
Let not thy love make thee an unbeliever. This my vow shall never, on my soul, be satisfied with my repentance. Let thy brother rage beyond a horrid tempest or sea fight. My vow is fixed.
Oh, my winding sheet, now shall I need thee shortly. Oh, my love, let me hear once more what I would not hear. Never?
Never.
May your sins find mercy as I, upon a woeful widowed bed, shall pray for you. If not to turn your eyes upon your wretched wife and hopeful son, yet that in time you'll fix them upon heaven.
No more. Go complain to the great duke.
No, Brachiano. You shall have present witness how I'll work peace between you. I will make myself the author of your cursed vow. I have some cause to do it, you have none. Conceal it, I beseech you, for the weal of both your fiefdoms that you wrought the means of such a separation. Let the fault remain with my supposed jealousy. And think with what a piteous and rent heart I shall perform this sad ensuing part.
Well, take your course. Francisco?
Sister. This is not well, Brachiano. My sister, she merits not this welcome.
Welcome? Say, she hath given a sharp welcome.
Are you foolish? Come, dry your tears. Is this a modest course to better what is naught to rail and weep? Grow to a reconcilement, or by heaven, I'll ne'er more deal between you.
Sir, you shall not know, though Vittoria upon that condition would become honest.
Was your husband loud since we departed?
By my life, sir, no. I swear by that I do not care to lose. Are all these ruins of my former beauty laid out for a whore's triumph?
Do you hear? Look upon other women. With what patience they suffer these slight wrongs, and with what justice they study to requite them. Take that course.
Oh, that I were a man, or that I had power to execute my apprehended wishes, I would whip some with scorpions.
What? Turn fury?
To dig that strumpet's eyes out. Let her lie some 20 months a dying. To cut off her nose and lips, pull out her rotten teeth, preserve her flesh like mummia for trophies of my just anger. Hell to my affliction is mere snow water. By your favor, sir. Brother, draw near. Sir, let me borrow of you but one kiss. Henceforth, I'll never lie with you. By this wedding ring.
How? Ne'er more lie with him.
And this divorce shall be as truly kept as if in thronged court 1,000 ears had heard it and 1,000 lawyers' hands sealed to the separation.
Ne'er lie with me?
Oh, let not my former dotage make thee an unbeliever. This my vow shall never on my soul be satisfied with my repentance.
Now, by my birth, you are a foolish, mad, and jealous woman.
You see, 'tis not my seeking.
Now horns upon thee, for jealousy deserves them. Keep your vow and take your chamber.
No, sir, I'll presently to Padua. I will not stay a minute.
Oh, good madam.
Twere best to let her have her humour.
Camilla's come, my lord.
To see her come to Brachiano for a dispensation of her rash vow will beget excellent laughter.
Where's the commission?
'Tis here.
Gentlemen, this matter waits upon me.
Unkind.